Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I can almost talk this morning. We were considering yesterday the preamble and introduction to a warning, a prophetic warning that Yahweh made regarding Paul. It's not God's first warning regarding Paul, nor was it his last. It wasn't a it was set amongst the theme of things. Well, I'm sure there was a warning prior to this. What do you think, Kirk, might have been what was something that we've already discussed, but was clearly a warning regarding Shaul, the founder of Christianity, the author of half of its New Testament, the one who set the religion against Yahweh's Torah? What do you think was the first, at least well-known, warning against Shaul, Paul, chronologically?
Well,
so many tough questions here.
I know about Chabahuk. I mean,
okay, but Chabahuk came after Yashayah, so Chabahuk is at least in the third position in terms of the order chronologically. You and I spent a lot of time talking about this individual.
Oh, Shaul, the
right. Yeah, because the book of Shemuel was written contemporaneous with the life of Shaul, of King Saul, and how King Saul serves as a model for all of the negativity, all of the corruption, all of the destructive and estranging behavior, the lifelessness associated with the wannabe apostle, Sheol, or Paul. So the first, because Shemuel was written between 1100 and 1000 BCE.
And it's always a prototype, too.
Right, and Yashayah was written around 750 BCE, Isaiah. And then Chabahuk was written around 640 about 610, I would say, about 610 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
So this gives you the timeline here in terms of the order of things. So we're now considering the second amongst these three prophetic presentations of the consequence of Shaul, the author of half the Christian New Testament. And so yesterday, let me read the opening statement here, and I was asking you about why do you think that Yahweh chose Ephraim here as opposed to some other designation. He says, woe, which is oi. Oy vey, you heard that statement in Yiddish? Oy vey, declaring a warning regarding extreme lack of understanding and the prevalence of delusion. To the presumptive, which means to claim something that you presume to be true but is not. Arrogant and conceited, self-important and a sense of self-importance and unwarranted authority, of moral failure, of agitation, and of self-adulation, of falsely claiming the authority and majesty of God. So the presumptive, arrogant, and conceited crown, Atara, the wreath, the trophy taken by the victor, the mark of human leadership within religious, political, and military institutions, whereby the common people are often surrounded and encircled and distancing themselves from God. And we yesterday considered the presumptiveness of Paul, the arrogance of Paul, the conceited nature of Paul, the agitation of Paul, the violence of Paul, the moral failure of Paul, all of which is obvious and undeniable.
Yeah.
And then we were considering crown as to why the word, the non-common word for crown was used in here, which is a tarif, which is this circular ornamentation that is worn to be either as a wreath or a crown to designate victory or triumph or of human leadership. And we found that Paul spoke specifically of those who were part of his religion, bequeathing him with a crown.
Mm-hmm.
That they were his crown, those that believed him. Then you say, oh, wow, this is really, really insightful in that regard. And then it says of the intoxicated, and we skipped over that for a moment, of Ephraim. And I asked you, so why was it of Ephraim?
Yeah. Well, as a serious student of Roman, British, American mm-hmm. Empire history,
yes,
all the characteristics of Paul are embodied in those people. And certainly, you can make a case for the Ephraim, the northern tribes of Israel. They twisted everything. They hate Judah. I mean, I don't know mm-hmm. where that started, but they came to hate Judah.
Right.
They fought.
As did Benjamin, because Benjamin sided with them in the hatred of Yehuda.
Yeah. Well, Benjamin is just they're awful to begin with, and they were told they were awful from the
yes.
start. But Ephraim was such a major thing through the line of Joseph that became bizarre that they would turn into such opposing country.
Yeah, in fact, I think you've already hit the two most important.
Okay.
And we'll go on from there. But I think the single most important reason that Yahweh chose is Ephraim is that in the book that Yahweh used to create the perspective that he had on the northern kingdom as Ephraim, what was his principal argument against them?
Well, that they turned to other gods.
Yeah, they were religious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to be really careful when we say, I use it all the time, so I'm not being critical here, but since there is only one God, they turn to false gods.
False gods.
Yeah. And that was Yahweh's principal argument against them. It's why he divorced them. He says, you've been unfaithful because you have turned and engaged in a relationship with false gods. Right. So they were religious. That was the argument against them. They were worshiping false gods.
Mm-hmm.
What is the basis of Pauline Christianity?
It's the same thing.
Exactly.
Dionysus.
So if you were going to use a term from Yahweh's perspective that speaks of God's disdain, God's divorcing those who are religious, what would you pick?
Ephraim is a pretty good one.
That's how he defines them. And he says, because of their infidelity, because of their desire to engage with false gods, think of Christianity, mm-hmm. the Lord, mm-hmm. Jesus, Christ, grace, the Trinity, the Queen of Heaven and Mother of God, all of those things.
Everyone is false.
Oh, absolutely, not equivocally. A religion based around false gods. And so that's the reason that he used the term. You know, I was reading an article this morning during the commercial breaks, and it was showing the Islamic State blowing up the temple of Baal Shamin, the Lord of the Heavens. And I knew this, and I just wanted to make the point. Do you know when the by whom and when the temple of Baal, the Lord, Shamin of the heavens, was first erected, and when it was built into the state that it was in, at least prior to the Islamic State destroying it on Sunday?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if you found out it goes all the way back to Ephraim.
No, oh, no, 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 no. As a matter of fact, it's vastly more troubling than that.
Really?
The oldest part, the inner sanctum of the temple to the Lord of the Heavens, was conceived in the first century by the Romans, and the temple was completed and it reached its highest status in the third and fourth centuries.
Well, that's telling.
So what the Lord of the Heavens was the principal competitor to all things Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And And it was established by the Romans and built by the Romans during the same time that Yahushua and Yahweh were fulfilling the promises of the Torah. And it was flourishing at that at the same time that Roman Catholicism came to grow out of the Roman Empire.
For a century, sure.
So it's, this is all the same time, the same message. And if you're a Christian and you see they blew up a temple, a pagan temple built by the Romans called the Lord of the Heavens, and your God you call the Lord, and you call him the Lord of Heaven.
Lord of Lords.
Wow. You ought to be really concerned, because that's the very God that was worshipped by Constantine and Theodosius and the first Roman Catholics.
But you're assuming that they would make that connection, and they won't.
No, but that's the truth. So anyway, Ephraim was chosen primarily because Ephraim, from Yahweh's perspective, is those who, he says, are not my children, who he has divorced himself from, which means they are outside of the covenant, with whom he has forgotten, because, and for a singular purpose, for a singular reason, because they were religious and they worshipped false gods. The very basis of Christianity.
They were a really big slap in the face because they built their own temples. They said, don't go down to Jerusalem.
Correct.
Don't have to do that anymore.
Correct.
They had their own priesthood. So they
correct.
At the Lowy.
Yes. And guess who the name of their, the principal name of their god was? Baal.
Baal, I'm sure.
Yeah. So here you go. Yeah. That's the principal reason. The second reason you've also mentioned.
Right.
The second reason is that they were vehemently opposed to Yahuda.
They even joined over the Egypt to go kill him.
Right. And, you know, when Yahweh was talking about this division between Yahuda and Ephraim and the split between the two and the fact that he's divorcing himself of Ephraim, part of that is that out of Yahuda would come Yahusha and the means to our salvation. And yet, what did Ephraim oppose?
Very same thing.
And what did Paul oppose?
Very same one.
You betcha. He opposed everything that came out of Yahuda, the complete fulfillment of the Moed Mikre. Now, I cut you off, Kirk, as you were explaining other reasons that Yahweh would have chosen Ephraim, and I think that the two that you mentioned first and foremost, and particularly the those two, are the primary reason. I had one other, and then I'm open to any others that you might have had. The third one that I have is really linguistics, because I like linguistics. What is the opposite, and you've already said it, what's the opposite of Ephraim? What was Ephraim opposed to?
Yehuda.
Yeah. Yehuda. And what does Yahud and Yahuda and Yahudim mean?
It means related to God.
Yeah, related to Yah. Yeah, related to Yah. And to relate to Yah. So if you choose Ephraim, you have that which is not related, that which does not relate to Yahweh. So from that point of view, it's a nice position. The other thing that I like too, and we've hinted all around this, but the Yisrael, if he had chosen Yisrael, which would have included all of the tribes, then he would have insinuated that that he was at odds with the covenant, because Yisrael is, Yaakov became Yisrael, and the covenant was made with Yisrael, those who engage and endure with God. And so he had to choose Ephraim over Yisrael, even though the northern kingdom was often called Yisrael, while the southern kingdom was called Yahuda.
Yeah.
Well, the northern kingdom, by the way, what's the consequence of the northern kingdom? What happened to them?
Well, they got taken off into bondage right away.
Right.
100 years before Yehuda.
Yeah, so they're estranged from the land, and they are estranged from God, and they were killed en masse. They were enslaved again and not liberated. So it's kind of the plight of religion, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a little more than a metaphor. This is it.
Yeah, this is it.
Yeah, this is your plight if you choose to do this.
Now, the word that he used before Ephraim, I skipped over, but I wanted to return to it, because it says the intoxicated of Ephraim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, intoxicated, does Yahweh ever infer that that the goyim that Paul sought out, that he speaks of in speaking of Paul being arrogant and naming him by name Shaul, and discussing his aversion to circumcision, but yet fascination with the male genitalia, when he was talking about Paul's followers, and Paul himself, didn't he associate drinking a poisonous brew and of them being intoxicated?
He did. You can. It's not just a alcohol.
No, he's not talking about alcohol at all, is he?
Spirit. You can be intoxicated by a
right.
Correct.
Now, the Gnostic nature of Pauline Christianity in Paul's writings, isn't there a battle going on in Gnosticism? How did Paul draw the line between good and evil in his letters, particularly in Galatians?
Flesh and spirit, yeah.
Flesh and spirit. So circumcision and the Torah was of the flesh, and those things enslaved, and they were bad. But the spirit, that was not of the flesh, it was considered good. And so an inebriating spirit is what Yahweh is speaking of here. It's
because
an intoxicating, inebriating spirit.
Yeah, I'm sorry. He never differentiates Paul, never differentiates the one spirit over the other to him. You know, his spirit is the same as Shimon Kevish's, his spirit.
And obviously it's not.
No.
So intoxication. Now, there's a lot of reasons that the Hebrew word for intoxication are used. It is shikor. It speaks of when you're intoxicated, your judgment is crippled, isn't it? Isn't that the principal reason that you can't drink and drive is because your judgment is impaired?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to be indoctrinated and tricked into Pauline Christianity, don't you have to have your judgment impaired?
That's what Christo.
Yeah, Christo means to apply drugs. Even in the sense of alcohol, it's a drug, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, it's called a spirit, isn't it?
Whiskey is a spirit.
Right. So your judgment is impaired. You know, in the covenant, you know, the difference between the gospel of faith where you do nothing and the covenant where you have to engage, you have to act upon the terms and conditions, doesn't alcohol also slow and delay and in ways cripple your ability to respond?
Sure.
So one of the problems of drinking and driving is that even if you were to recognize a pedestrian in the crosswalk, your ability, the time it takes you and the coordination involved in responding is deteriorates.
Mm-hmm.
So you're no longer able to make the right judgments or to respond appropriately to God. So, Kirk, I guess you could take the approach of that there wasn't really any intent to using these unique words throughout this presentation of Yahweh's testimony as he moves towards calling Shaul deadly in the 28th chapter of the most important of all prophetic books, Yashayah. Or you can say, well, you know, a literal investigation and observation of these words really is extraordinarily revealing.
Well, it's in light of what we covered with King Shaul,
mm-hmm.
as well as what we know about Habakkuk,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure we would have grabbed it quite so quickly.
I would agree.
Had we not done the other two.
Yeah, I would agree. But
it leaps off the pages now, doesn't it?
Right, it does. And particularly when you begin with the word oi, woe, where I'm talking to you, I'm warning you about extreme lack of understanding and the prevalence of delusion. So, the extreme lack of understanding, prevalence of delusion, you're talking about pervasive human, political, and religious doctrines.
Right.
And then he begins the same way he began the other, talking about someone who is presumptive, arrogant, conceited, self-important, mm-hmm. with claiming unwarranted authority. That's exactly how he begins not only Chabaouk, but isn't that these two concepts, how the discussion with King Saul begins? You know, I'm warning you. Whoa, Israel, you don't want this. And then talks about the ego and the self-serving nature of political leaders.
Well, you probably come to the conclusion, the collective view, we probably come to the conclusion, as my wife said on Friday after the two programs Friday, she said that, you know, it's the same, the gestalt to her becomes that it's the same story. He keeps warning us from the start, and he's telling us there's a pathway home. Mm-hmm. And here's the plan to get back, and it's the same story all the way through. And and the same thing with Paul. The warning of Paul is more than just the warning about what Paul said, as much as the embrace of the people who embraced it and how they've screwed up the world since.
Correct.
It's the characteristics of Paul as much as Paul himself. I mean,
correct. Paul was unknown, then he would. But if Paul was unknown, do you think that Yahusha and Yahweh would have spent this much time warning us about them?
It's because they ran with the ball. They picked up the ball and ran with it.
Yeah. The if you do not ascribe the Paul of Christianity to these warnings, then you are left saying, well, then God was just mumbling to himself because there's no one else in human history that meets these criterion. And then you have an irrelevant deity. So if he's not talking about Paul, then he's either wrong or irrelevant. And if he is talking about Paul, then Christianity is wrong.
Mm-hmm. And it's more than obvious that it is Christianity.
Right.
It can't be anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly the same thing. In fact, even having the third word being crown. What was the issue with the King Saul? They wanted to have a king, someone to wear a crown like other Gentile nations.
Mm-hmm.
The crown. And then isn't it obvious, just telling that Paul then claimed this crown for himself?
Yeah, and it's pervasive through history after that.
Right. And isn't Paul providing the leadership for the religion of Christianity by having laid its foundation?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And then it is bad judgment when you're warned about the consequences, as Yahweh did through King Saul, of choosing a king. And every consequence is negative, deadly, it's destructive. It's in every possible way counterproductive. And you choose it anyway. And you realize that you have to be... Your judgment has to be impaired for you to embrace Paul. And that Paul's whole mantra was the spirit versus the flesh.
Mm-hmm. And if anyone doesn't think that Christianity and Paul are synonymous, can I read two lines out of one of the most famous little commentaries, Haley's Bible Commentary, which has been on everybody's thing throughout the, in America at least. It's everywhere. And here's what it says. They were talking about it was talking about the Damascus, the vision in Damascus and all. It says it may be, in part, at least, that Stephen's martyrdom was a price paid for Saul's soul. And what a soul. Next to Jesus, the greatest man of all the ages, the one man who, more than any other, established Christianity in the main centers of the then-known world and altered the course of history, Saul of Tarsus. If the Christians are going to promote him that way, this is the next to Jesus, the greatest man, we ain't got God's name, I mean, Yahusha's name,
but
the greatest man of all the ages.
Right. And just think about that. You know, because what about Adam?
Yeah.
What about Noah? What about Abraham? What about Yitzhak? What about Jacob? You know, what about Moshe? What about Yahusha, the son of Nun?
Mm-hmm.
What about Dod? Didn't Yahweh call him the most righteous, the most... if you're going to name his kingdom after him, wouldn't Dod be absolutely unequivocally the king? And by the way, since Yahweh is saying that he's going to establish his kingdom on earth as the kingdom of Dod.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a tussle for the crown, don't you?
right.
between Shaul and David.
Correct.
Just as there is a tussle for the crown between Yosha and Paul. And you have the two people that it rightly belongs to not wearing it.
Correct.
The two people who had the same name, who claimed it, dying as a result of it.
Keep it topical. Ephraim set up their own kingdom. Mm-hmm. They were never given, that was not one of the blessings given to Ephraim.
No.
It was given to the Yehuda.
Yeah.
I mean, they had the scepter.
Yep. It's the name used to describe Yisrael apart from Yehuda, the second son of Yosef.
Mm-hmm.
A name deployed by Yahweh and Hosha and Yashayah to describe the northern kingdom during their separation from Yehuda and divorce from Yahweh when they disassociated from the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
This is the next statement of the first, next sentence, the second sentence of the first, what's called the first verse. I don't even like the term verse.
Mm-hmm.
So then, the flower's beauty, desirability, and honor foolishly fades away. Its attractiveness, which beneficially by way of the relationship, was a valley of olives first and foremost. So he's talking about the consequence of this intoxication of Ephraim. And it says, so Ephraim, as one of the, as a group of many of the 12 tribes, really all but Yehuda, because Benjamin sided with him. So then the flowers, this is the blooms, this is the attractive and reproductive part of the plant, that which flourishes and shines as a result of engraved inscriptions. That where those that are T-S-Y-T-S. So this is signpost, hand, signpost in terms of the letters. That this is ones whose faces were gleaming and sparkling. Even the salt which preserves food. And the wings that enable birds to fly. So all of this stuff, the wings that enable birds to fly, the salt which preserves food, smiling, faces gleaming, eyes sparkling, a flourishing and shining life, the reproductive part of the plant, the attractive nature of the plant,
mm-hmm.
that all foolishly fades away. And so with trysts, there's so much insight there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how are you going to reproduce children in the covenant if the reproductive part of your nature is gone?
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to be attractive to God if your attractiveness is gone? How are you going to shine with Yahweh if you no longer are enlightened by His engraved inscriptions?
Right.
So he even talks about faces gleaming, eyes sparkling, the salt in the wings. All that's gone. In other words, Ephraim, because they were descendants of Jacob and therefore Yisrael at one time, had all of these things.
Oh, yeah, indeed.
Then he even goes on. Yeah, goes
think
on to say.
Lineage. Think of the lineage.
Right.
This is from Joseph.
They were originally part of the signposts along the way. All of it squandered. It says beauty, desirability, and honor. Sasby, again, a signpost word. This was signpost plus family home plus God's hand. Their desirability, their honor, their beauty, their growth, their splendor, their prominence, their attractiveness, their appeal. Their ability to reach out, stretching out one's hand, foolishly fades away. All of that positive. God created them in the center of His plan.
Mm-hmm.
Offered them this marvelous inheritance. Communicated His nature in their midst. Went into Mitzrayim to draw them out and take them home. Gave them the promised land. Gave them His Torah, made them desirable and beautiful, productive. And they squandered it all. Nebel. All of that was dishonored and disgraced because they became senseless and vile. They treated God with contempt and rejected him. As a result, they languished and withered. They were played for a fool, according to the definition of Nebel.
Mm-hmm.
Stupidly becoming worthless and immoral. Isn't that what happened to first the Yehudim and then the rest of the world?
Okay.
When they embraced not only King Saul, but also the wannabe apostle, Paul?
Well, it's amazing that it happens. I mean, you say, well, how are they so close to Yahweh and then they just lose it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what one of my good friends says all the time. Can you imagine? How is it even possible that you could have witnessed after 400 years of hellish torture and slavery in Egypt, and Yahweh intervenes with all of these miracles to free you, and then you build a calf against him? So why would you throw it all away? You know, we talk about the children of Israel being freed by Yahweh after the 10 miraculous signs communicated through Moshe, and then parting of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba, so they could get off of Yoruba Beach and cross into Saudi Arabia, that he later used to drown the Egyptian military that was chasing them, trying to kill them and re-enslave them. And you get to the other side, and you're thirsty, you know, it's been a while, and Yahweh provides you with food, he provides you with water, and there he is at the top of the mountain. You can see his brilliant light. He is providing instruction to you, he is taking care of you, protected you, and the first thing you do is you build a religious altar, and then you erect in gold a golden calf, which was a bull with a sun disc between its horns, mimicking the religion of the Egyptians.
Mm-hmm. How sick do you have to be?
What did Yahweh do to him?
Well, he divided them and wiped out half of them.
Yeah.
Like of them, 5,000
yeah.
of them or something.
Yeah, he killed them.
Yeah.
So what do you think Yahweh thinks about religion?
I think he feels the same way.
Isn't the lesson there is that if you're going under those circumstances, you've been exposed to Yahweh and his saving and liberating nature, and you choose to be religious in his midst, are you welcome?
No.
I mean, no.
Today's theme.
Yeah, there he was with the children and taking them to the promised land, and people decided to be religious. They were not welcome in his midst, were they?
No.
They wiped him out.
Now, let me interject one thing back to Ephraim just for a second. Is
mm-hmm.
when you analyze his name, it's a man who is being nourished by the Almighty,
mm-hmm.
lifted up and covered by the Spirit. How does that get to where Ephraim got? The only other word I could find was Ephrah, Roth, which is the same man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using the letters, of course, the Rosh and the Pei and so forth. And still, an Ephrah, associated word, is possibly a root.
Mm-hmm.
But associated root, that's a man being nourished by the Almighty as a signpost along the way.
Well, you know, Yahweh's using signposts along the way, all the way through this, and says that Ephraim was originally a sign. And that it's Ephrah, and then the M is plural, yeah. And he is constantly referring to them as originally they were his children.
Yeah.
So, they're part of the covenant. They were his children.
And you ask the question, how do you go from there to there, or for that matter, it's kind of...
he explained it. They became religious.
Yeah. So that should horrify you.
Right. Yeah, and we'll look at the children of Israel that were freed from slavery in Egypt, freed from the religious and political clutches of and military clutches of Egypt. Yahweh went and freed them for the various things, the exact same things that religious people thronged to. You know, that this integration of politics and religion and militarism And Yahweh freed them from those things, and they chose to erect a religious monument, an altar. God says, no, you're not living with me. You're as good as dead. So let me make the point. It also underscores this idea that not only aren't religious people welcome in God's company, because God was with them, so he's not going to tolerate religious people in his company, but by killing them, he's saying they weren't salvageable.
Yeah.
You know, if you are exposed to what Yahweh is offering.
Hello? Oh, he did? Okay. Well, the point being that I'm sure he was going to say that the when you're not salvageable, then that seems to be a point when God just absolutely walks, either totally walks away from you, or he can destroy you, as he did with the people he said that were no longer salvageable in the land of Israel when they returned from Egypt. But most of the time, it's just he walks away from you and doesn't protect you. And when he does that, of course, then there's nothing to protect you from the world, from Satan, from other empires, and you can be destroyed.